Okay, do it. Go on, do your R.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, to the Creepless Nervous Podcast with a K. My name is Christian Corley. I am the editor of Casterbus, and with me are my two podcast droids, James McLean and Brian Terranova.
Hello.
Podcast droids.
Yes. Here to serve your needs for podcasting.
Excellent, Brian. Excellent. Okay, we've got...
I'm more of a C-3PO vibe, so I can just talk as I do.
Yes.
Like camping glitch.
Yes, you can.
Typical.
You not need me, so I'll shut down for a while. this week's Casterbus podcast with a K is we're going to talk about fan productions. Initially, we were just going to talk about fan movies that have been, you know, that appear on YouTube that fans have made, and they're kind of obviously they're based on Doctor Who, and they're always done with good intentions, and sometimes get a really good script for them, but more often than not, they leave you a little bit dissatisfied that perhaps maybe they could have done better. But obviously, you know, they're working with limited budget, so all we can say to those people is we salute you, go for it, you're expressing yourselves in marvellous ways. However, over the last few days, new material has come to light. So we're going to start off talking about the new version of Power of the Daleks. Then we're going to chat to a gentleman from the United States, Dennis Spielman. Oh, I'm going to chat with Dennis about his Doctor Who-inspired production. And then we're going to move on to exciting news about a new live, in front of a live studio audience, in front of a live audience, as a theatrical...
I hope they're alive.
They certainly should be, although it's Robots of Death, so they may not be alive for too long. Mm. Which is going to be taking place in July. So, gentlemen, Power of the Daleks, that excellent fan film that has come to light. Now, Nick Scovell's been doing various versions of Power of the Daleks on stage over the years for fundraising purposes. And if you didn't catch his news on Casterbus, dear listener, he has some great members casted. He's got Barnaby Edwards, who you'll know from Doctor Who. He is a Dalek. Regularly. Nick Briggs, who provides Dalek voices. And Lisa Bowman is also on it. Also appears in it. And it's a two-part film that appears on YouTube. At the moment, just the first part is available. The second part is due to appear later on. And then both parts are going to be screened as a single, so probably around 30-minute adventure at a charity event in September. It's very different, though, from the original material. The core of the story is there, but the setting, everything's changed. What did you think about the changes, guys?
I like the imagination behind it. I like the idea of taking the base storyline, which, if you're in the fan filmmaking world, or even just an independent filmmaking world, sometimes the ideas are the hardest to come up with because you want them to be as good as they can be. You know, like, ideas are plentiful, but you want them to be as ingrained and intricate as they can be in TV and movies. So taking one that's already ready-made and unfortunately not available any longer in any kind of visual medium is a neat idea. I think it actually works well. And I like the concept. I like the location setting because it does, certainly from a filmmaker standpoint, makes it easier for them. Because all of your sets and all of your props and so on, you know, they're from the modern day. That's what you have plenty of access to. So it just makes a lot of sense. I think it was a good call, and I actually like what they've done with it.
Okay. James?
I don't know where to go on this one, to be honest. I feel a bit awkward.
Well, be honest.
You want me to be genuinely honest? I don't know. I don't know if I want to be, because I think I can hurt people's feelings. I think... I stand by what you said earlier, which I quite liked, is that I do salute anyone who is looking creatively to do any project and does a meaningful project, something that they want to do. I love the fact that we have the mediums to actually explore that and to indulge in these sort of things. So on one hand, I doff my hats, because it's not easy putting these things together, as we know. Anyone who's done anything creative knows if, as soon as you collaborate, it's a hard medium to pull anything that's vaguely good into place. I don't know. I've never been into Doctor Who fan films or any fan films, really. There's always a part of me which kind of thinks, well, you know, you've got that talent, you've got that drive, do something new, You know, don't pilfer from the past. I know that sounds really horrid, and that's really is my honest opinion. And even though comic-wise, now as a student, I did a load of Batman fan comics, actually. They were sort of done for a website, and so in a way, I'm as guilty. Although I was asked to do it, I didn't actually want to do it particularly. It just seemed to work with what I was doing at university. But I have gone down those sort of avenues, so I don't want to be too much of a hypocrite. But generally speaking, personally, yeah, it was a nice idea to put it into a different territory. I like the fact that rather than trying to fight to do something which is similar or comparable, that you try and do something that's different so it can stand on its own 2 feet. Mm-hmm. I think that's good. I just sometimes wonder whether, you know, energies could be better spent doing something a bit like Power of the Daleks, but just get rid of the Daleks, get rid of the Doctor, and try and generate something entirely new and your own that stands on its own 2 feet. But at the same time, good on you. That's democracy. You wanted to do Power of the Daleks. You went and you've done it. And I respect that. I think that's good.
Okay, fair enough. You know, I mean, I think it's very polished. I think it's clearly been storyboarded. It's lots of scenes and shots are well framed. I'm excited by it. We don't have the original, so we can't enjoy the original in its full form. To reimagine it and compress it down in this way for modern audiences, I think it's a clever idea.
Yeah.
Gives them the chance to get to know the story, maybe then go and explore it in more detail, get hold of the audios. Yeah, there is the whole thing about fan productions not being original. A lot of them drawing from other sources, and maybe, you know, there must be like 100 Time War inspired Doctor Who fan movies on YouTube and other places on the web. But I think this is a genuinely great attempt to do a fan movie with a guy who knows the original material inside out. He's been doing it. He's been performing it for years for charity. So I'm really excited by it. And yeah, I think it's good. I think it's good.
That is important. It's important that people feel it's good. I'm just voicing my own personal stance.
Well, I know where you're coming from. Where you're coming from. I mean, back in the dark mists of time, I did an A level in film studies, and to sort of fill in the time where I wasn't doing film studies, I also did a City and Guilds in television and video production, and we storyboarded and plotted and began to script a short 15-minute film, which was part Doctor Who, part X-Files, mm-hmm. as you know, like as everyone was doing in the mid-90s. But you know, we were using big, hefty, super VHS video cameras. You know, we were using the old type of shuttle-controlled VHS video editors, and it took a lot of planning. And you know, nowadays, you can just whip a camera out of your pocket and take it home and edit it that night on your computer. You don't have to book time that you in a studio that you're sharing other people with, or in an editing suite that you're sharing with other people, etc.
You know, though, in a sense, that does make it easier, but it's still not as easy, because even though your equipment is easier and your editing equipment is easier, your time with the people that you're filming with and your locations and the time you have, they're still slim.
Oh yeah.
Like I said, being an amateur filmmaker, we find that, you know, first of all, you're not only limited to the time that you have with people, because you work, you may have families, you have social lives, and you have to try and work on those set days, but you're limited to the people that you know. Majority of times, if you want to rely on getting a production done, to be the actors in your work. And unfortunately, some people you can coach to get somewhat of a performance that you'd like on screen out, but most people aren't actors like you are, or don't have the drive. They're doing it as a friend to help you out. In this case, I'm not sure who these people are, but, you know, and I don't want to be rude to any one of them, but it is a fan production, and the acting in it, you do see what you see in a lot of fan films, which is that they must not have a lot of rehearsal time, or some of these people aren't used to film versus stage. And it shows a little bit. Some of it's really good, and some of it shows.
I think it does. Do you think sometimes it's to do with the editing and directing as much as the actors? Because I've noticed it a lot, and you can get some very polished looking, especially these days, where with the cameras and the post effects you can do, you can get some very polished looking work. And sometimes I find, and I'm not pointing this at this one specifically, but when I've seen other fan films in other genres, there's sometimes there's like pauses and there's break and there's sort of what I would feel slow cuts, which make actors look worse because the scene hasn't moved quick enough. It hangs too long, or, and it can only be a couple of seconds. That can make such a difference to a performance or to a power of a scene or to a dialogue. And sometimes I wonder if the actors, unfortunately, get a bit of a rough time, and sometimes it's the edit. Because if you watch, say, Doctor Who Confidential, and you see a film being shot raw by a secondary camera on Confidential, the acting never looks as good as it does on the screen. And that Absolutely, is obviously yeah. the power of the director and the editing. And I sometimes think fan films do suffer from that.
I think there's a timing issue, isn't there? There's the editing side of things, but I think there's the amount of time that is available for actually recording, for, you know, playing the scene out, recording it.
Yes.
You don't have the opportunity for lots of retakes, do you? And more often than not, using a single camera, so you don't have the opportunity. I mean, I know a lot of dramas use single cameras nowadays. But, you know, in the old days, you'd have multiple camera setups, which would maybe get around having problems with lots of retakes. But, Brian.
No. I was just going to say that is a big issue. Sometimes you're fighting. You plan. You have the best intentions. You storyboard. You plan out the hours that you're going to do. You plan the people that you have, and you swear that you can get even just two pages of script shot. But before you know it, the hours are all gone. And at the end of the night, you're pressing on. Do we press on and just get all the shots that we had planned for today, or do we try and get quality over quantity? And sometimes you just know that you don't have the time to finish the product, so you try and press through to get it all done, and unfortunately you have what you have on film. It can work either way. If you do take the proper amount of time, unfortunately you're still left with, like James had pointed out, the director. A lot does fall on the shoulder of the directors, because you have to try and get the performance that you want, but a lot of times it just does come down to time and trying to finish the project, just period, rather than in a timely fashion. It's just trying to finish the project.
That's what's kind of good with these sort of things, and I admire whether I feel any affinity to the concept or not, is the fact if they get a final product up there on YouTube, because so many creative things you see people saying, oh, we're going to do this, and you know 90% of them will never get past planning stage, 50% right. will fall apart when they're trying to get people together, and then, you know, and then 90% of them say do one part and never do the second or third. But you have, if we go back to the power of Daleks that we have here, it's an accomplishment, and that is something that you can admire, is regardless of the material, regardless of what you think of the quality in there, and I do think the quality is very good, it is something which has been completed, and I'm always very pleased to see creatives who've got together on an idea and taken it from A, B, all the way to C, and got something out there that they can be proud of and say, regardless of you think, this is a culmination of an artistic journey.
Absolutely.
That's how it's cool.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. I have been a fan of fan films for quite a while. I do enjoy them. I like watching them on YouTube and so on, and seeking them out wherever I can. And, you know, and when I say that, it's not that I sit there and say that these things are fantastic. They need to be in a TV show, but I enjoy the creative nature behind them. Just like how we write for Casterbris, how we do the podcast for Casterbris, how other websites out there do the same damn thing, or do their comic books or whatever. It's that creativity. And the one thing that I've always said, certainly going to conventions and seeing their costumes, seeing their comic books, seeing their fan films, their websites, is fans are an extremely creative lot of people. And I love that creativity that is out there. And I do enjoy that. And while some of the products may not be the best pieces out there ever, I applaud the effort behind them, and I applaud the creativity that went into them.
Sure.
Plus, they can be a platform as well. I mean, the one good thing about when you take a concept you already know is that you take 50% out of the problems in actually kickstarting an idea, because you've already got your basic premise down. It can be a very good stepping stone for creative minds to actually move further into a professional industry if they so wish, because it's a very straightforward platform to get onto, learn, experience, and then maybe go to new things, and maybe then, you know, do original things later on. And I mean, obviously a lot of people involved in this are already either involved professionally or do stuff, but just a general rule, that's another exciting thing about fan projects.
And what's neat about this one too, when you think about it, you've got Barnaby Edwards and you've got Nick Briggs, and they kind of got their start in this whole fan film world.
Yes.
You know, and they're not forgetting their roots. They're coming back to it, which is something that's very interesting. They're giving back to it in a sense, if you want to think of it that way, or they're helping to keep it alive. I found that very interesting, and I really just. Because I've watched a lot of what Nick Briggs had done before, or Gary Russell, or the BBV videos and so on. And, it's interesting to see that just kind of hasn't stopped, despite the fact that he's in the Big Finish realm as well as the BBC Doctor Who realm.
Gary Russell was in Octopussy.
Was he?
Was he?
He is, yeah. He's, the scene where I think they're in Germany, where Bond has been thrown off the train. And okay. He's running along a road and he eventually gets picked up by two fat Germans in a 2CV or something. Before that, there's some kids in a convertible and they stop and he runs after to get in and then they drive off again. Gary Russell is one of the kids in that.
Get out.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
But it is cool that, I mean, obviously with Doctor Who now, just generally, it is built on a platform of fandom. I mean, where you take Russell T. Davis, you take Stephen Moffat, you take Mark Gatiss, I think, to a degree. I'm not sure on him, but certainly Paul Cornell, as you say, Gary Russell, Nick Briggs, absolutely. All people who were there in that sort of either working in doing fan fiction, fan stuff in the 80s, or were people who were keeping Doctor Who alive in various forms in the late 80s, early 90s, late 90s. And they sort of became the godfathers of this new show. So in a sense, perhaps I can sort of knock myself back a bit from my earlier comment that, you know, in a sense, this is what's so wonderful about fan productions, is that they can lead to, you never know where they're going to lead. These people could be the next people who end up supporting the show.
Sure.
Definitely. So that's a good thing. I just personally, I'm not over interested in seeing them, sadly. And I knew people when I was doing the comic stuff who had the same issue about what I was doing as well. So fair play, I can appreciate that, but yeah, it's good stuff.
Okay then, well, we'll move on in a moment to the interview, but before we get there, we've had an email recently from our listener who was a little bit disappointed to find that we were no longer listed on iTunes, or it wasn't working correctly. That problem is now resolved, so if you are listening to us on the site and you would normally listen via iTunes, just head back to the iTunes page. It has been fixed. A little problem at the Casterbus end there.
Our listener's very fussy. I mean, there's only one of him, and there's so many different ways to actually listen to this podcast, and he has to have every different way.
And since the iTunes problem, he has listened 50 less times.
Oh, that's pathetic. I mean, that's 50 podcasts without
listener.
What
kind of a fan is that?
I know. We need a better fan base. We need a larger fan base.
We need another fan.
We do. That would double.
Listener, can you get your neighbour to tune in, please? Thank you.
Maybe we should advertise.
Maybe we should
advertise for another fan. Hold auditions.
Auditions for another fan.
Yeah. Well, listener,
I like your thinking, Terra Nova.
Listener, coax in another person. Doesn't have to be a listener, but if you can breed with them, we could actually have. We could be actually manufacturing a future of listener.
A listener factory.
Well, I mean, if our listener, he or she passes away, we've got no listeners left. But if he or she has had a child, at least we know in the future that the legacy of the listener will carry on.
He's right, you know.
He's absolutely right.
Recently on Casterbus, we featured news of an interesting new Doctor Who inspired fan production. Funded by crowdsourcing, the Time Travelling Troupe is the brainchild of producer Dennis Spielman, and the idea is simple. A group of actors improvise time travelling adventures in front of a live audience, and the results will then be published on YouTube for us all to view. Fortunately, to find out more, I've got Dennis on the line now. Dennis, hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Excellent, cool. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Time Travelling Troupe?
The Time Traveling Troupe follows a trio of characters. The star is Rachel Winstead, who plays as the Traveler. Mm-hmm. As she basically comes to Oklahoma City one day, and she picks up two companions. The show is going to be completely improvised.
Okay.
Basically, no script. Everyone's just kind of making up stuff as they go along. get some suggestions from the audience at the beginning of the show and just roll with it.
That sounds great. And how are you performing it? Are you doing it in front of a live audience?
Yes, it'll be in front of a live audience at Reduction Theater.
Okay, and these are going to be recorded and they're going to go on YouTube. Is that right?
Yep. Well, I have a couple people. We're going to film with multiple cameras. So it's going to be like pretty much like a sitcom. Like you'd go to like some studio show and see like Saturday Night Live or something like along that line.
Okay, that sounds really good. Now, the interesting thing about this, and you know, there's dozens, probably hundreds of fan Doctor Who projects going on out there, but you're using a crowdsourcing model in order to raise funds for it. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we got a lot of expenses. We got to rent the theater space. We actually want to build some sets and props and, you know, got to build our time machine, of course, and pay everybody. But in exchange, there's cool gifts.
Which is how it generally works how it generally works on Kickstarter, isn't it? Projects are launched and then for a different level of investment, the person running the project will give a special version of the end product.
We're no exception. Yeah, we got everything from just a special behind-the-scenes stuff that you get kind of sneak peek access before the public does, from DVDs and Blu-rays, and we even have season passes available.
Okay, that sounds really good. Improvisation's obviously it's a tricky art for anyone to do. Never mind, even actors that have been doing it for years sometimes find themselves absolutely stumped by some of the suggestions that they get. So, do you have anything in the works, anything in process, anything to fall back on if you know that it doesn't work out as a kind of consistent piece of work?
I have very talented improvisers working on this show, and they've been doing it for quite some time. And with the whole audience, and they're able to kind of like get feedback off of each other.
Yeah.
And keep the thing going. That's why they're really talented about that. It's just keeping things going. And they're able to like cut scenes. If a scene's not working, you know, they're going to be able to like cut scenes and have different characters come in and pick up from some completely new location and kind of keep the show rolling.
Okay. So are you going to be recording it as live, or is it going to be edited down and then put onto YouTube?
With some technical limitations, yeah, we're going to basically record it live, and then edit the video, make it look nice and pretty, and choose right angles, and then it'll be uploaded to YouTube on a weekly basis.
Okay. There are a few, as I said, many different Doctor Who-related spin-off fan projects. Yours is obviously quite different. How did you stumble upon this, or happen upon, I should say, this particular concept?
I've always kind of wanted to film like a studio audience kind of show. And I've just kind of been fascinated by that, because that's not something in where I live, that's just not something you can go do or go see. And I've always all right, well, I want to do this thing, but I don't have a script or anything. It's like, wait a second, I'm friends with some really talented improvisers. The improv scene's just growing huge, thanks to in part of OKC Improv. The improv scene's just exploding. So I basically was able to pull together some great talent to build this show. Because I've always also been fascinated by time travel, because none of the groups really do with time travel. And I'm a huge fan of Doctor Who, and it's like, you know, I can kind of do this kind of original show, kind of inspired by Doctor Who and other time traveling stories, and create kind of a 12-episode sitcom. Okay. And that's kind of what kept me, that's kind of just how the whole thing just kind of evolved, just from like wanting to do one thing to another and merging everything together.
Okay. So you've got Rachel Winstead as the traveler, and who's with her?
Her companions is Kyle Brawler and Jesse Kyle, also great improvisers.
Okay. And they're playing the two companions. Is it Travis and Tiffany? Is that right?
Travis and Tiffany, yes.
Okay. So you're producing. Are you also an actor as well? Are you going to be getting involved in front of the audience?
I will. Most of my role is I will be back behind the camera, behind the scenes stuff. I have done in front of the camera stuff, and I have a, you know, I've been in improv before, so I'm able to relate to the actors and help and the improvisers and help direct them on a much closer level and give them feedback that they can actually translate. I can translate to them a lot easier, and they can relate to, and they can perform even better.
Okay, so you're a Doctor Who fan as well. How long have you been a fan?
I kind of got into kind of the newer stuff. I think when I first, the first episode I saw of Doctor Who was Rose on PBS, public broadcasting station here in the States. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of watched it and it was like, cried. I was like, this is so sad. This is just one little episode I saw. What's like the rest of the show like? And I think the next one I saw on PBS was with the Doctor and Donna at Pompeii.
All right.
And I was like, wow, that's really good too. It's like, so I took like a bold risk and I basically bought I know I'm gonna like this show, and I basically went on Amazon and bought like seasons 1 and 2 on DVD and watched it as much as I could, as fast as I could, because I was really soaking it in and really enjoying it.
Wow. That's quite interesting, because the guys I do the podcast with, we're all sort of long-term Doctor Who fans, but you're a guy who's a modern Doctor Who fan first. So have you watched any of the old stuff?
Yeah, I have gone back and watched some of the old stuff on Netflix. Mostly kind of stuff what people have recommended. Like, you definitely got to check this one. This one's actually pretty good. And kind of slowly over time, kind of caught up on some of the old stuff.
Okay, cool. So how do you find the two in comparison?
I fell in love with the modern stuff, and I'm just kind of a modern filmographer myself. I'm kind of really attached to the modern stuff.
Yeah.
With Matt Smith being my favorite Doctor.
Right, that was going to be my next question. He's great, isn't he?
Yes, I love his energy.
He's not my favorite Doctor. My favorite Doctor is a man called Tom Baker, but
Baker was great too.
Yeah, he was awesome. But I do think Matt Smith is my second favorite, which is quite an achievement. Right, so when does the time traveling troupe, when's it all planned to start? Obviously, you've got a set period for your Kickstarter campaign.
Yes, we do.
When does that come to an end?
Actual end date's May 7th.
Okay.
Is when that ends, and we'll actually start filming the show in kind of late June, June 21st.
Right.
It's when we'll film our first two episodes.
And the plan is, I think I'm right, I think you said, is... Once you've done the episodes, they get edited and then put on YouTube weekly. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Right, well, thanks very much for speaking to us, Dennis. And don't forget to get in touch with the details when it's live, and we'll link to it on Casterbus. And all the very best of luck with it.
All right, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Now, dear listener, it's been announced this week that a live performance of Robots of Death and its Kaldor City sequel Stormmine are going to be performed live at the Greater Manchester Fringe. And on the first day, it'll be running for a week, at the first venue, which is the Fab Cafe, and the second week at the second venue, which is the Lasso Gary, which previously held the performance of Midnight for a week. On the first day, on the launch day, on July the 1st, it will star Paul Darrow, formerly of Blake 7, where he played Avon, and he also appeared in Time Lash and Silurians?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, and he was in Silurians?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the unit guys in Silurians, yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Yeah. He dies. Really?
He
dies. He's a red shirt then.
Yeah, he dies in it. He's got a fairly
he's in it.
He's got a fairly
couple
big
of
role.
Episodes, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, is he a corporal or something?
I'm something tempted like to find out, so we don't sound silly.
I'm pretty sure he's in more than one episode.
Yes, he is. And in the Kaldor City as well, isn't he? He's in the plays for that.
Indeed, yes. He plays the character of Caston Iago, which I think I'm pronouncing, or Iago. I'm pretty sure it's Iago, though. And it's that role that he's performing in Robots of Death, as well as in Stormmine. Now, naturally, because Robots of Death is a Doctor Who story and there are restrictions on the license, there are no Doctor and Leela parts in the Robots of Death adaptation, which is why the character of Carsten Jago will be appearing there. The same happened with Midnight. There was a guy called the Doctor, and that was it. In fact, he wasn't even called the Doctor. He may have been called the Doctor. I can't recall. But you know, this is the premise. There is, because it's a licensed property, you can't have Doctor Who's name involved in any way whatsoever. So with Robots of Death, which has been performed with Chris Boucher's blessing, and using the original rehearsal scripts, writer Alan Stevens has gone to work and produced a stage version of it, which will be performed in front of a live audience, which is really cool, isn't it?
Hmm. I think it's actually brilliant, because I kind of like the idea of the story of Robots of Death without the Doctor. I know that sounds a bit funny, but I mean, I love Tom Baker and I love the show, but I kind of like the idea of seeing Robots of Death performed without that feeling of safety that you get with having the Doctor there.
Well, you know, a lot of Doctor Who stories can actually be told without him. You know, you just replace it with a character from within the story, and a lot of them are just mysteries or murder mysteries or anything like that. And you know, they don't necessarily have to be Doctor Who stories. You've just thrown in this character outside his normal element. You know, so a lot of them will work well, but Robots of Death certainly is one of them. I mean, there's a massive mystery going on there, and the crew of the ship can sort it themselves. So it definitely would work great as a stage play. I would see it. I would see it for sure. You guys are lucky. We don't get anything like this over here, you know.
You should find someone who does, or do it yourself.
I've thought about it, actually. I've thought about trying to get a theater group together for something like this.
Mm-hmm.
I should actually poll my friends. Now that I have a lot more friends who are kind of interested in this realm, I should actually start seeing if we can't make one happen.
There's isn't there an ambiguity in the Caldor City? Because the Caldor City audio plays were by Boucher, weren't they?
I'm not sure if they're all by him, but I'm pretty sure he's involved strongly. Yeah.
Isn't there a subtext that is suggested that Darrow's character could be Avon? Because there is a link, obviously, between the Caldor City and Blake Seven.
Mm. I don't know. I have not listened to Caldor City.
I have not, and I've really wanted to if I could find the money, because there's obviously been a few, and I wouldn't want to just get one. But I've read on various Wikipedias and things that there is a suggestion that the character could possibly be an Avon post Blake Seven,
right?
Because they have a Carnell in the Corpse Marker, which was the BBC book, wasn't it, by Chris Boucher?
Yeah.
Where he brings the one Carnell, who was in an episode of Blake Seven called Weapon, into the Doctor Who universe, into Caldor City. So there is a suggestion that there might be I don't know how true that is, that the Paul Darrow's character arguably might be Avon.
I love the way the two universes collide, though.
They do collide quite well.
And
in
various ways, because you've obviously got Terry Nation.
Yeah.
And then you've got Boucher. And then you've got that horrible, really sinister and totalitarian world in Frontier of Space, which ties in with the Blake Seven world. I'm not sure if they're chronologically the same, but
interestingly,
that whole atmosphere.
If I may put myself on the altar of Lance Parkin again and bring up a history, as I recall, he says that there is I recall that Blake Seven was meant to be set, according to its early its Bible or its early synopsis, in something like the 30th century.
Right.
And around that time, Lance Parkin's history breakdown of the potential continuity of Doctor Who, you could fit Blake Seven roughly around that sort of period where the Federation, there is a sort of like Galactic Federation, and there is questions of whether it's of its integrity.
Yeah.
So it does sort of fit. And then, of course, you've got the fact that it was done concurrent to Doctor Who.
Mm.
So there's a lot of aspects of the actual visuals of Blake Seven, which sort of fit with Doctor Who as well. So they dovetail quite nicely, yeah. I kind of like seeing them in the same universe, because it's kind of... The problem with Doctor Who is that because it's always with the Doctor, well, most of it anyway, until recently, you always get to see the fantastical elements of these time and periods, which of course are fantastical because the Doctor's there and often with a monster or two, which is meant to be abnormal. What is wonderful, if Blake Seven was part of it, is you'd almost be getting a feeling of an era in the Doctor Who universe without the Doctor and how things exist without him plundering problems with his TARDIS. And I like that. So, yeah. But anyway, no, I think it's great. I think it's great to have Paul Darrow in for one. I think it's wonderful. It's a wonderful choice, Robots of Death, because it's just so suited to stage as well. It's, it has that feeling that it could just work so well.
Yeah, it's good because there's a lot of dialogue, isn't there? I mean, there's a lot of character-based dialogue, you know. Like Midnight, I think it's an ideal choice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair to Robots of Death, I mean, Robot Death is obviously a homage to Agatha Christie.
Sure.
To the whole tenor.
Well, you've got all that, you know, the whole backstory and, you know, like the founders and the big mad fashion headwear and all that going on, and the eye makeup and the invasion of the CSO disco dummies.
Yes.
But there wasn't that much
running around corridors in it.
Exactly.
It was a lot of scene sets, so you could. And as I say, that's possibly why it would work, because, you know, Ten Little Indians wasn't about watching people running around getting killed. It's about people being disappeared to a certain degree. Yeah. So it just sits for stage really well.
And there was a lot more character development in it as well, rather than just robots killing people and the crew trying to stop it. You know, there was the one character who thought that her brother was murdered by the captain. Yeah. There is the robophobia, which you know, affected the guy who was there trying to sort out the issue. You know, there was a lot of depth within the story, and a lot of meat for actors to play.
And
certainly
Crouch,
for Paul Darrow to take over, like you're saying, the Doctor role. I mean, you've got somebody with massive stage presence.
Yes.
So you've certainly picked the right person, whether or not he's actually doing a Blake 7 crossover or not. He's definitely got the audience's attention.
Yeah, it's a shame he's only doing the one day, but I imagine there's several reasons for that.
It's a great bit of publicity.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yes, he's just perfect. I mean, he is very much a stage actor in the way that he approaches a lot of roles. He's got that sort of stage presence, which some people find uncomfortable on television. I never have, but yeah, I could see him just.
Was he over the top in Time Lash?
He was said to be. He was apparently told to tone it down, and he didn't. He just did. He always did. But I liked him for that.
There was that.
Supposedly, he and Colin Baker were out trying to outdo each other, weren't they?
Well, that's I can believe that. I just love the photo the publicity photo of him with the robot's head.
Yes.
In the kind of Hamlet-esque pose. You can't actually see him holding the head, but he's just screaming Hamlet at me.
Oh, no, it's good. And he was Captain Hawkins in the Silurians, and I think he was in for most of the episodes until the last one, I think he dies.
Yeah.
So he had quite a big role in that.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, all the best of luck to the Las O'Gari Productions. Gareth Cavanagh, yeah. friend of Casteris and the podcast, is behind that. So best of luck to them for that. And we'll try and get Gareth on the podcast to talk about it in more detail closer to the time. That brings us to the end of this week's Casteris podcast with a K. So it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me.
Just once.
I did it last time, didn't I? Did we edit it out?
Well, I wasn't here last time.
No, the time before that. She's so annoying. And it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Oh God, you pair. Yeah, I am not partaking in this camp.
And it's goodbye from me.
Oh, well, that's staying in.
Hey, goodbye. If you were going to play the Doctor, okay, and you're looking for somewhere to hang the performance as a starting point.
So you mean as a starting point, though, for your own? For me, honestly, whenever I think about it, whenever I think about doing my own, I try not to think about the quirky, eccentric natures of the Doctor. I think what it is I always stick with the idealisms and the goals. Like he's a traveler who just wants to enjoy doing what he does, and he keeps getting caught up in these moments, which in an odd sort of way he also enjoys, but he wants to help people. So he wants to just enjoy traveling and learning and experiencing, and he wants to help people as well. And that's always the basis for the character. Any kind of eccentricities or character traits that come out after that, they're down to the actor. You can write in certain little ones because there are certain things that you write in the script that are Doctor-ish, but I don't try to write or think too much about, like, he needs to be this quirky, he needs to do these things. That just comes out when you're writing or when you're acting it, to me.
Yeah. I was thinking along the lines of, you know, how the visual look for the fourth Doctor was supposedly from this Toulouse-Lautrec poster. So I was thinking, if there was, like, a famous actor you would use as a stand-up, like, supposedly David Tennant's look came from the fact that Jamie Oliver turned up on Jonathan Ross in a suit and plimsolls.
I actually... For working on a fan film of my own a couple of years ago, I was kind of heavily basing my look on Tony Curtis from The Persuaders.
Okay.
I really loved that cravat tie look that he had going on, and that the way he did it with his suits and so on. And it was something that was quirky enough I had thought that would really work for the Doctor, and I even liked his portrayal, to be perfectly honest. I loved the way he would double talk and move around. And not that I wanted it to be identical to him, but I was really heavily influenced by that look for my own. But you'd be surprised how damn hard those cravat ties are to get the way that he wears them. You can get them and they just look like you're going to somebody's wedding. But the way he wore them, they always just looked like these beautiful flowing ties. You know, I loved those things. He had a great look.
How about you, James?
I think I would go timey-wimey on this a bit. I've always liked the I've always had a love of the sort of Edwardian. I've always particularly loved the sort of Woodhouse, Jeeves and Worcester, Blandings sort of novels, and I love the sort of upper class eccentricity. Well, not even necessarily upper class. What I was going to say is Campion.
All right.
I like which was obviously played by Peter Davison.
Yeah.
Which I, funnily enough, is how I think possibly the Fifth Doctor should have been dressed. In something a little more straight, something that you would have seen in either the 20s or in perhaps All Creatures Great and Small, which again had Davison, but I'm thinking more of James Herriot or Siegfried, something which is quite smart, but carries a certain amount of presence and isn't eccentric. It looks slightly out of place. I think the Doctor works well when he looks slightly out of place from everything else, because he is meant to be anachronistic to a certain degree by nature.
Yes.
But doesn't look like he's trying to be out of place, which was John Nathan Turner's mistake with question marks. So, I mean, if you look at Sylvester McCoy, you look at Peter Davison, you see elements of their clothing, which does come more from that sort of All Creatures era, I suppose, which obviously influenced John Nathan Turner, I'd have thought anyway. So I'd have that, but I agree totally with what Brian said. I think that's utterly true. I think when you're looking at trying to work out the Doctor, it's his joie de vivre, I think, is important. Mm. And that joie de vivre is totally... unrestrained by adult conventions, and so it's got to be an almost youthful excitement. No matter what age you're playing it, there's got to be a youthful excitement there for life and compassion as well. And if you look at all the Doctors, that exists. And if you take, as I did, I was listening to Happiness Patrol, read by Rula Lenska, and she was doing the Seventh Doctor's McCoy's voice with more of a Scottish accent than McCoy has, which is kind of funny. But what I found listening to that, which made me interested, I could almost hear William Hartnell in the dialogue, even though I was used to seeing Sylvester McCoy doing it, which just shows if you write the Doctor right, you can swap over the faces and the voices, and it should still feel like the same person. And I could see Hartnell in that version of McCoy.
Right.
And I also saw Hartnell in a bit of version that Carolyn John did in the Silurian audio adaptation of John Pertwee, which sounded not at all like John Pertwee really, but felt more like William Hartnell. And I think, but that is because there's got to be a certain anachronism and a certain joie de vivre, which I think Brian encapsulated perfectly.
Okay, cool.
What's about you?
Oh, Clint Eastwood.
Oh.
Dirty Harry.
Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
You can see it. It's obvious.
Say again?
I mean, are you serious? Are we talking about, are you trying to be serious here? Are you trying to be funny?
No, I'm not. You know,
are we talking about the aesthetic or are you talking about the presence?
I'm talking about the way he's dressed in the second film in Magnum Force.
Right. Oh, I see.
Also the attire. Okay.
Yeah. But also his mood in that film as well. You know, in the first film, he's very black and white. And as the films go on, he becomes less black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so the one with Sandra Locke in, he should have had her banged up. but he didn't. That's one where she's playing a rape victim who goes around killing the people that raped her, or that were involved in a rape. The name of which I can't think of at the moment. But in Magnum Force, he's just slightly mellower than he was in Dirty Harry. He's got a good companion. The people he's fighting against are what the stereotypical view of Dirty Harry is from watching the Dirty Harry film. You know, you've got David Soul and the other guys on the motorbikes going around assassinating criminals. So, but in the second film, he's a bit mellower than he's in the first film. But he also looks really good, and his whole demeanor in the second film is really cool.
It's interesting. But I mean, there is something in the Clint Eastwood persona, if we take him out of Dirty Harry and just generally, there is a sort of almost like a paternal strength to him that you could almost envisage with the Doctor. There's a feeling that he's very tough in all his films. Yeah, there's you feel that's just a like his skin, like a rugged skin, but there's a sort of compassion and a belief of natural justice which permeates through his spaghetti westerns and through his crime thrillers.
Yeah.
And that would sort of fit the Doctor.
Yeah,
very
totally.
tough outside, but inside you get these glimmers of that real genuine person. And yeah, I think that could actually work really well for a Doctor. And
I think
new.
As well, the thing with Eastwood is the fact that he's been, you know, he's been there throughout most people's lives.
Mm.
You know, as certainly anyone born from the 1950s onwards has this like quite a well-known name, and then turned into, I mean, he's the only real Hollywood superstar who's still working, who you could put in the classic superstar category. And yeah, you're right. He has that quality throughout the majority of his work, the vast majority of his work. And then you've got all the stuff that he directs as well. And you know, it's in the subtexts as well. Marvelous,
yeah.
Marvelous. I think it's easy to just forget. And I hate saying that. People just forget. People are always forgetting. But I think it's easy to overlook that he's more than just the guy who plays Dirty Harry or the guy in the cowboy films. He's done so much excellent cinematography, hasn't he? And a lot of people just think of him as Dirty Harry.
No, I mean, I always look at him not so much as Dirty Harry, but he, to me, embodies a character acting, a hero character acting, which we lost in the 1990s, where everything... lead characters had to become more whimsical. I think possibly Bruce Willis sort of led the field on this, and it sort of permeated into television as well. And into comics, you didn't have these sort of very withdrawn characters, withdrawn heroes, that you were looking for those moments where you would see some spark of anger or of compassion. And they weren't just constantly wisecracking and jumping around and being a bit of an ass, which is what so many heroes do these days, including the Doctor, although Doctor was doing it obviously when Eastwood was doing a lot of his films. And I miss that. I miss that a lot. I've been playing Red Dead Redemption, as I think I've said to Christian several times. And, you know, the lead character in that is obviously based on that model. And I sort of miss it. I miss that sort of thing. I'd love to see Doctor Who perhaps played with a little less of the whimsy and just for one regeneration, something a little deeper and hard to pin down. Eccleston was almost there.
Yeah, yeah.
But he didn't seem quite comfortable with the humour in it. But he was the closest, I think.
Right, we're going to leave.
You're still there, Brian?
I'm here. Yes.
Are you gobsmacked that we're suggesting such an Americana as a template?
I am. As far as I understand on the internet, that's sacrilege.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. No, actually, just what I was just picturing what you were saying about Eccleston, and I guess you're right, he almost was there. I was even thinking that to a degree Sylvester McCoy could have gotten
yes.
there.
Yes,
you know, like they were just getting him. That's the thing about his era, they were just getting him right to where he needed to be, right to some brilliance, right, bringing back Doctor Who right to where it could have been, and then they shot it down, and that was a sad thing. But he definitely had that. He played that with that darkness. And I don't think that would necessarily be a bad thing. I mean, he's seen a lot. He's faced a lot. And I think every once in a while they give them that dark tone. But you're right. We never really had one who was just completely kind of more serious or more put together in that way.
Well, I think you're right. I think maybe McCoy was the quintessential close, even closer to Eccleston, because Eccleston was still playing the post-90s, obviously hurt, pained person who had a lot of issues on his hair. You know, but with McCoy, those issues were way buried. They were there, but they didn't really come up. You knew where they were smouldering under, and that's what Eastwood used to have. He was sort of the typical the macho man who buried everything. He never explored it, and it just became cold inside, and that's where McCoy was going, and that made him mysterious. It made it you didn't know quite where he was going to turn, and we lost a bit of that with the new Who, where obviously we do explore a lot of what the Doctor feels and why he feels it. And he's prone to crying occasionally too.
I was just going to say, new Who really brought out the emotion in the Doctor, which
new
which,
Who brought out which... the boo-hoo.
And on that note,
it's goodbye from me.
You did it, damn it.